Hello, I'm Ken McLeod, Principal Teacher at Unfettered Mind. Our website is an ongoing effort to explain Buddhist practice in a way that is clear and accessible to the Western mind without dumbing it down. If you find these teachings useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate so we can continue to maintain and expand the site. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind, Outer Realms and Inner Experience.
I think we're just starting on impermanence, right? Itself, okay. So that's page 83 in Kenchok Jeltsin, and page 42 in Gunther. Yeah, we talked about the four ends. The end of all meeting is parting. The end of all accumulation is dispersal. The end of all building is ruin. And the end of all living is dying. Did anybody look up Ozymandias? Okay. Monica here? Yeah, that's you. Did you get my message about the difference between the opposite of life? Okay. Is that satisfactory? Okay. Just wanted to check.
Can you tell us?
Well, it should have gone to everybody in the Facebook group.
Oh.
Yeah. I thought it was a very interesting question, and it basically came down to, for me anyway, you look at the ability to respond to one's environment as a spectrum, and when you get something like a rock, it doesn't have much ability to respond to the environment. It just, everything is crystallized. And the other end, you get things that are totally responsive. So it's the degree to which energy is crystallized. Thinking about it, when you think of, when do we say a battery is dead? Battery's dead when it has no juice in it. And so I think it works quite well from that point of view, the ability to respond. So when a battery's got juice in it, makes things happen, can influence surroundings, can influence other things. But otherwise, one becomes more and more passive, or inertia becomes stronger and stronger. Okay? Crucial distinction here is between basically what's alive and what's not alive. Well, it's presented one way here. Schools of Buddhism actually have very different interpretations. There's a story of a Zen teacher who was coming back from town to a monastery, he was attacked by robbers and tied up with a kind of very, very long grass. And when he didn't show up, the monks at the monastery got a bit worried about him. Eventually they sent out a search party, and there they found him tied up with this long grass, and so they untied him. Said, why didn't you just get up and, come to the monastery? So I couldn't bear to pull the grass out by its roots. So he had a relationship with the world in which everything, even grass, was imbued with a life and spirit. In the classification that is presented here, this is quite widely utilized in the Tibetan tradition. A distinction is made between sentient beings and which are the inhabitants or the contents of the environment, which is regarded as a kind of vessel or container. And when I pursued this with various teachers, the usual explanation of the difference between the two is that sentient beings can move around for the most part, and the rocks and mountains and trees are relatively immobile. So that was the explanation that was given. Of course, when you get into detail of various esoteric kinds of plants and animals, we find some certain animals are extremely immobile, so it doesn't quite hold up. But as a general principle, that's what was operating here. All that follows here is a framework for meditation, and shouldn't really be regarded as, I don't think it's that helpful to regard it as a scientific classification of experience. It's a classification so that it gives you a structure for being able to consider every aspect of one's experience from the perspective of transitoriness or impermanence. It utilizes the cosmology that was prevalent in India and Tibet in these times. And I think we it's very important to distinguish between cosmological systems according to the use for which they were developed. The Catholic Church got very, very badly caught with the Ptolemaic cosmology, which the sun and stars revolve around the earth, so that when Galileo postulated and actually proved the opposite, that the earth moves around the sun, following the work of Copernicus and Tycho Brahe and so forth, well, he was held up for heresy. Now, when you're dealing with a mystical, spiritual tradition, the spiritual tradition's description of the world and of experience is developed for one purpose and one purpose only. And that is as a way of coming to be more awake. And that's a very, very different function from being able to predict the behavior of phenomena, which is what scientific system is primarily aimed at. From this point of view, there is no real conflict between science and religion. Such a conflict arises only when one or the other ventures into the other's domain. So when you try to use science to explain phenomena of awakening or of the way experience arises, You get into some rather strange stuff. And most of the studies on consciousness today are really bad because the basic philosophy is very bad. There's a persistent tendency to ignore what's called the binding problem, what makes experience our own. And similarly, when religion seeks to, or spiritual systems, seek to explain or dictate how the world should be, as Karen Armstrong points out, you always end up with disaster. Because what you're concerned with in spiritual traditions is coming to know the mystery of being itself, which is not exactly the subject of scientific inquiry. And the methodologies are so very, very different. One of the things that I've been doing here is showing or attempting to show you how a lot of the language here is mythic. It's not pointing to things that are actually real, but pointing to things that are real in the sense of existent phenomena. But things that the ways that they are describing different aspects of experience. Whenever these mythic or symbolic descriptions are interpreted literally, then you get very strange things happening. And this is really at the basis of much of the conflict between fundamentalism and the modern world. Today, there's a literal interpretation of the Bible, which produces such things as creationism and intelligent design and all of this stuff, which is not even a pseudoscience. It's a misinterpretation of religious truth by interpreting it literally. So this is a bit of a long aside, but when we're reading texts like this and many other texts like the Bodhicaryavatara and so forth, as well as spiritual texts from other traditions, one should understand them as pointing as being descriptions of psychological and spiritual evolution, not an internal experience. In the same way, actually, in very, very similar ways, that fairy tales are descriptions of internal experience. My favorite example, for instance, is Cinderella. And in the beginning of Cinderella, you have this young girl whose life is wonderful, and she's adored by her mother and father, and has everything that she wants, and she's able to do whatever she wants, and it's just great. And then her mother becomes ill, and goes away and dies. And her father remarries. And the new wife brings two children. And the first child's world is completely ruined. And now she has to take care of these two children, and she no longer is the sole focus of attention. This is exactly the experience of the eldest child when siblings come along in the family. The mother gets pregnant and goes away, and when she comes back, there's this other thing that has just ruined her world. So children gravitate to these stories because even though this is rarely explained in these terms, it echoes with their internal experience in a way that they can relate, and it tells them that they're not crazy for having the feelings that they are and so forth. And spiritual scriptures and accounts and stories and so forth do exactly the same kind of thing. And I think it's very, very important for us to read these things with this kind of attentiveness. Otherwise, one takes these things literally, and then you get some really, really strange things happening. So, primarily this is a guide how to reflect on one's experience so that one can take in the truth that everything changes and nothing stays the same. And what we have, I mean, the way that we experience the world is, well, there are all of these people and animals and so forth that move around, and then there's the rest of stuff that doesn't move around very much. So now we get into the cosmology here, from the lower cosmic circle of wind up to, but excluding the fourth stage of meditative concentration, there exists nothing of permanent nature, nor anything solid or unchanging. Sometimes what is below the first stage of meditative concentration is destroyed by cosmic fire, what is below the second stage by cosmic water, and what is below the third stage by cosmic wind. What is all this about? What are these four levels of meditation and so forth? Well, part of the cosmology here is that we had the realm of desire, which is basically dictated by wanting. And this includes the hell realm and the hungry ghost realm and the animal realm and the human realm, the titan realm, and the desire realm gods. But it's possible for the mind to become so still that it is no longer functioning on the basis of desire. And that's what these four meditation realms refer to. Levels of stillness in the mind, so that desire is only there actually in potential. It's no longer there explicitly. Now, how many of you have rested in your meditation sufficiently deeply that the hankering after experience has subsided? Yeah, even if it's for short periods of time, you know, where you're just, you know, you don't want or need anything. You're just completely at peace. Now, broadly speaking, there are four levels, and they're actually broken down into 17 and so forth. We don't need to get into all of that at this point. But this is a map of states of mind, not a map of the universe itself. Now, I haven't thought all of this through, but this terminology of the elements of water, fire, and wind, I suspect refer to specific qualities that are present or not present in some of those very, very quiet states. If I did a bit more research, I could probably establish the correlations, but for the most part, this stuff is just presented as how things are, because for the Tibetans and for Indians, they thought the world was like this, and so they didn't question it any further. And I remember Atta Rinpoche, who's a wonderful teacher who still lives in England, expressing his complete dismay when he went to a meeting in the early 60s or maybe the mid-60s, after the Tibetan diaspora, where the senior lamas of the Tibetan tradition were going to debate seriously whether the earth was flat or round. They were that wedded to that to that cosmology. There is a mistaken translation that I should point out here in the Kenchok Jeltsin. When I read it, yeah, in the middle quote it says the world will be destroyed by fire seven times and then once by water. When it's been destroyed by seven times, then it'll be destroyed by fire seven times. I think that actually should be wind. That there's a progression from fire to water to wind. What this is saying is that even the stillest states of mind are subject to impermanence, that you just can't hang out there forever. And a lot of people, they think, oh, well, I could just hang out here forever. And saying even those very, very still states of mind pass, and you're going to be back in the swim of things. And the reason this is important from a Buddhist point of view is that just quieting the mind is not enough. One has to know the nature of experience. Just resting isn't enough. And this becomes quite important because there's a stage of shamatha, of resting meditation, which is very, very commonly mistaken for being awake. Because the mind just opens and it's very still and clear and you think, oh, I'd like to be awake up. But no, one's actually just experiencing the stilling of the conceptual mind. The knowing the nature of experience is another level of attention that needs to be developed. And then transitoriness or impermanence of the subtle is what we ordinarily take to be impermanence. Seasons come and go. Days come and go, and so forth. And when we live in the city, we aren't as much in tune with the coming and going of the seasons. When I was in the three-year retreat, we lived extremely simply, of course, and we just had our rooms and There were no cars, there was no traffic. We had lived in a grove in the woods. And because every day was just the same, it was almost like watching a movie an accelerated movie of the seasons passing. You'd wake up one morning, oh, the trees are in flower. And then next morning, oh, now they have leaves. And then the next morning it'd be, oh, now the leaves have fallen. Oh, now there's snow on the ground. And time actually sometimes went almost that quickly. It was like, one got just a feeling of this constant change. And of course, if you're out and you're seeing the phases of the moon every night, you get this sense of change. There's plenty of change, as we know here in the city, but we don't actually stop and experience it as change. We get caught up in it. But stand on a street corner and watch all the cars go by, watch the people, and just get a sense of how much is constantly changing in one's world all the time. And this is about the world around us. And then on page 44, it turns to sentient beings. The three world spheres are transitory like a cloud in the sky. The three world spheres are what I was talking about a few moments ago, the desire realm, and the form realm, and the formless realm. The desire realm embraces what we usually know as the six realms. The form realm consists of the gods who dwell in meditative states with incredible states of stillness. But even though their minds are very still, they still have the sense of having a body. It is also possible for the mind to become so still that you have no sense of having a body. And that's what the formless realms refer to, is that kind of stillness in the mind. And there are four levels of that, which we'll be discussing a bit more when we get to the chapter on karma. But just so that you know what the terminology means, you have what are called the three world spheres, or the three realms, which are the desire realm, form, and formless realm. And then you have the six realms, which are the hell beings, hungry ghosts, animals, human titans, and gods. All of those, to be absolutely precise, when you're talking about the gods, you talk about the desire realm gods, the forms, and the formless realms. All those comprise the gods, and then the rest are the other five realms, and that makes the six realms. What both of these descriptions do, whether it's in the three realms or the six realms, they're describing the whole range of ordinary experience when there's a sense of self-presence, a present. That's what both of those maps do. They describe it in two somewhat different ways. In the six realms, the realm of the whole range of experiencing is being described in terms of the worlds projected by reactive emotions. In terms of the three realms, the whole range of experience is being described in terms of the degree to which mind is disturbed. Is it disturbed by desire? Is it sufficiently quiet that it's just resting? Is it so quiet that there's not even the sense of form? So they're two different maps of experience. Basically, what they're saying here is that everything is subject to impermanence. So now it breaks it down into more detail. And it goes to concentration on death, the signs thereof, on life as it draws to an end, and on separation. So this is one way you can meditate on impermanence. That the first thing is, I'm going to die. And this is Rinpoche's favorite way of starting off talks with new people. I remember once in Hawaii, we were staying with a couple, and the woman's very sweet, and they were retired, and he was a hard-nosed engineer, businessman from aerospace, I think. And over dinner, he kept asking Rinpoche, why is it necessary to practice religion? Why is it necessary? Well, what's the point? Isn't it all hocus pocus, etc.? So that evening in the public talk, Rinpoche started off by saying, well, there are about 400 people at the talk. And some of you are probably wondering why you're here. So let me start off by saying that there are three kinds of people who don't need to be here tonight. First, all of you who know you're not going to die, there's no point in your being here, so you might as well leave. Secondly, all of those who know that when you die, nothing's going to happen. And if you know that's the case, then you might as well leave, because I don't have anything to say to you. And the third kind is the people here who know that when they die, if they're going to be reborn, it's going to be in something better than they have now. If you know that, that's fine. But if you don't know one of those three things, then maybe you want to stick around. And then another time we were in Vancouver, and we had this wonderful dinner, very nice home. And it was typical Vancouver winter night. It was just cold and rainy and miserable. After dinner, the husband of this couple said, why is it important to practice? And Rinpoche said, well, right now we've just had this lovely meal, and here we are sitting around, we have a nice fire, and it's all warm. Imagine what it'd be like if you had to take off all your clothes, go out into that cold, dark, stormy night, and know that you could never come back here. Well, death's much worse than that. And then there's a case of, who is it? Minnesota. Zen teacher starts with K. Can't remember. Anyway, had this huge fundraiser put on. And so all of the glitterati of Minneapolis are gathered here, and they've, you know, the usual things. So they've been wined and dined, and now here comes the Zen master, who's that they're all there to give money to, and so he comes downstairs, looks at everybody, and says, "You know that you're all going to die, don't you?" And it is probably the single most important thing to take in about your life, that it's going to come to an end. And it's why teachers talk about it again and again, because when you really take it in, you begin to relate to your life as your life, not as the way we were discussing before, as the life which society has conditioned you for. So... and it takes a lot of work to overcome all of that conditioning. Then the second thing is attention to the signs of death. And the third here is to be conscious that life is passing moment to moment.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.